My friends, our purple mountains with ramparts red glare, white with foam and justice for all, fruity plains gallantly streaming from sea to shining sea, with a shining city on a shining hill above a shining prairie and maybe some shiny trees and a few shrubs, I see a shiny America.
Welcome to PID Radio. I'm Derek Gilbert.
And I would be Sharon Gilbert, and welcome to our bunker, everybody. You've reached us on Thursday, June the 8th of 2006. You know, it's the same year as it was yesterday.
That is true. Things haven't changed, at least as far as that goes, and we're still operating in the same spatial dimension as we did yesterday.
We don't switch dimensions.
No, absolutely not. We're sticking with this one. We're playing the cards that we were dealt.
That's right, buddy.
Just about 7:30 here, bunker savings time, and that is, of course, UTC minus 5. A program note. The Remnant Radio Network, which has been airing our new programs every night at 10 p.m., Central Time, that is Greenwich Mean minus 6, UTC minus 5, wherever that places you in the world, you do the math. They're backing us up 1 hour. It'll be at 11 p.m. Central Time from now on. There were a change with some of the times of other programs that he was carrying during his day, and this just worked out best for him. So our new program every day, Monday through Friday, will air at 11 p.m. on the Remnant Radio Network, which streams live on the Internet in several different formats at remnantradio.org.
And they're in this dimension as well.
Yes. And the program will repeat the following weekday at 1 o'clock Central Time. That's 1300 our time, or 1800 UTC. And but it is a repeat. It's not that you've time shifted or phase shifted or anything like that. It's just a repeat of the previous
show.
No,
that's true. But it is available in the year 1832 in another dimension.
Okay, we're getting silly.
We really are. Well, you know what? There's a lot that's gone on today.
There certainly is.
And, of course, the day started out with a bang.
Yes, and we'll get to that in just a second. Just want to tease ahead tonight the final part of our three-part interview with David W. Lowe, author of Earthquake Resurrection.
Well, that's the best way to end the show.
Yeah, yeah.
Let's just go right to him.
No.
We must digress. We must blather.
Yes, we must digress. It was interesting getting up this morning and seeing the news. First thing that Abu Musab al-Zarqawi had been killed for the 17th time in this dimension.
At least.
Well,
good heavens.
Yeah. Now, let's just say right from the get-go that we would certainly like to accept that this story is as it's been presented to us by the mainstream media, and that this is a good thing.
We'd love to believe every word that we have heard come out of mouths and that we've read online and in the paper today. I have to say, my day started out great. I opened my eyes. There's my husband saying goodbyes. He's leaving for work, and he goes, "Good morning, honey. So Cowie's dead."
Yeah.
And I said, "What, again?"
Yeah, exactly. So I did a little research on that because I had to follow that comment. And let me run through the timeline of just the stories. And I just did a very cursory research. If I'd had more time during the day, I probably could have turned up more. But
it's funny. You're supposed to work over there. So
the boss has this thing about me actually working while he's paying me. So, but here's what I turned up just from a very quick Google search. Thursday, March 4th, 2004. Dateline Baghdad. A Jordanian extremist suspected of bloody suicide and attack was killed some time ago in U.S. bombings. And a letter outlining plans for fomenting sectarian wars of forgery. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi was killed in the Sulaymaniyah Mountains of northern Iraq during the American bombing there. And again, that was March 4th, 2004. October 16th, 2004. American military assault in Iraq on the militants may have created a major blow for Abu Musab al-Zarqawi and his organization in Fallujah. According to some sources, he may have tried to escape, but then died in the process. That was October 2004. May of 2005, May 11th, Iraqi official says al-Zarqawi seriously injured, possibly dead. June 2nd, 2005, Fallujah Sheikh says al-Zarqawi died on Friday. September 16th of 2005, Baghdad Imam claims Zarqawi is dead. And wait, there's still more space dust. On November 20th, 2005, report from the Jerusalem Post, al-Zarqawi may have been killed in Mosul. So those are just 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 in the span of just, you know, 5 minutes searching through Google. So
is he part cat?
I'm not sure. And the interesting thing is that he died either in Baghdad or in Mosul or in western Iraq near the Syrian border.
You know, I have read some opinions that say that he died in the original, in those mountains. Mm-hmm. And he's been dead since.
Right. In fact, that was the story that came from the Fallujah Sheikh, or Baghdad Imam, rather, and Dateline Paris. That was the September of 05 story. Sheikh Jawad al-Khalisi, the imam of the Al-Khazamiyya Mosque in Baghdad, told the French newspaper Le Monde that Zarqawi is dead. He's simply an invention by the occupiers, meaning Americans, to divide the people. And this sheikh was quoted as saying that his family in Jordan even held a ceremony after his death. Abu Musab al-Zarqawi is therefore a ploy used by the Americans. This was last September. Now, he may have his own reasons for fabricating a story, too.
I don't know. But, you know, the problem is you don't know who to trust. The one thing we can say is we do know that not everything our government tells us is true. And they will tell us, we can't tell you that because, well, that's
national
security. Yeah, we can't tell
and, you know, even when the story comes out, most people don't know. I was talking about this at work today, and I said, well, you know, we got into Vietnam on a lie. And they's like, what? This was a story that was reported a few months ago in...
Gulf of Tonkin?
The Gulf of Tonkin incident, right. There was an Australian newspaper that picked it up. It did get some play around the internet. I did a little searching for that at lunch. And, yeah, some people did report it. But most people didn't hear about it. The fact is that the NSA fudged the data that they gave to President Johnson, which said that the North Vietnamese fired on our ships in the Gulf of Tonkin, and that was the justification that Johnson used, or that was the evidence that Johnson used to base his decision to commit fully to Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
Now, according to the information, President Johnson did think that it was a legitimate event, but the NSA's own records, admit that they fudged the data and did so deliberately. So, and that's just one example of many.
NSA, I mean, go fall on your sword.
Yeah, the you know, the Spanish-American War. Remember the Maine. You know, all of
I
that
know.
Stuff. So,
well,
but you know, pointing this out on the internet today on my blog got me officially labeled a left-wing moonbat. I was labeled a left-wing moonbat by a blog called Super Happy Fun Blog or something. No, it was the Super Fun Power Hour, which is not to be confused with Dave Von Kleist.
Super Fun Happy Slider.
Yeah. It's not to be confused with the Power Hour folks, Dave and Joyce.
No, hardly.
Because I'm sure that they agree with our take on things. It's like, this may well be true, but we're reserving judgment.
They called you a left-wing moonbat?
Called me a left-wing moonbat because I didn't accept the mainstream media story at face value. They showed us a picture. They told us he's dead. Therefore, it is so. Well, guys, look at history. Come on. Mm-hmm. But, you know, it's just confirms our position as the radical center here in America. Because we've got left-wing folks, liberal folks, who think that we're just way too conservative to, you know, breathe air. And then we got right-wing folks, the ones who are just rabid followers of, you know, Little Green Footballs or whatever those blogs are, who think now we're moonbats because we don't buy the story and we're not celebrating like Sean Hannity on his show today. It's a great day. I'm proud to be an American. Okay. Well, again,
listen, let me tell you something that will make you proud to be an American. Early as this story came out, different news agencies were sending out as quickly as they could descriptions of the events. Very early on, a description came out from the AP. And I would give, I do know the name of the person who wrote this, but the reason I'm not putting it on here is because this story has since been updated.
Okay.
And they're supposed, anytime they change a story, they're supposed to put update 1, update 2, whatever on it. And they're supposed to say what they changed.
Right.
Nuh-uh. No, this story is being changed. And the story that his byline is now on is not this story.
Not the original story.
No, so I left it off. So if you read the story and watch the news, top terrorist killed in air raid, that's the actual headline. I added, but were children in that house?
Right.
Because if you read the very last two paragraphs, you see video from the scene of the attack showed children scrambling over a flattened jumble of cinder blocks, concrete reinforcing bars, blankets, blue plastic bowls, and other debris. This is a family house, folks. Mm-hmm. A pickup truck was scorched and crushed. Two young members of the crowd showed the camera a child's sandal, mm-hmm. a backpack with a teddy bear on it, and a stuffed animal.
Demka is reporting that a woman and a child were among the seven people killed along with El-Zarqawi. So it appears but that was the part of the story that was removed from the update.
Exactly.
Yeah, the part about the children or the child.
Exactly,
being in the
because
house.
Exactly because that, you know, it's one thing to say we bombed a house, we got him. Mm-hmm. It's another thing to say we bombed him. He happened to be in a house with innocent people.
Right.
With children.
Mm-hmm. And it's a little tougher to take joy in an event like that. And again, we're not saying that El-Zarqawi is a victim.
No, heavens
or that
no.
he's a good guy.
No. We don't know the guy.
We don't know the guy. And the point that we're making is that the only information we have about El-Zarqawi is what we're being told through government spokesmen.
Mm-hmm.
And when we add that to the documented fact that government spokesmen have lied to us more than once,
mm-hmm.
we have to reserve judgment. And right now, it appears to be true. This appears to be a good thing if it's all true and accurate. But we also have to note that there have been at least six other reports that we can find over the last 2 years mm-hmm. of his death. So
yeah. Now, picture this. If El-Zarqawi had raided a home of American citizens
mm-hmm.
to kill someone that was on their top wanted list.
Right. A soldier or a general or
exactly.
something. Right.
And took out the general's wife,
mm-hmm.
took out the general's kids.
Yeah. Oh, these monsters.
Well, just bear that in mind.
Mm-hmm.
And as we've said many, many times, we are so behind the soldiers, the men and women on the ground.
Yes.
You're doing your job. You're doing what you're told to do, and sometimes, God love them, you're asked to do things that are tough and distasteful.
And that leads to our next story, which is one that's being reported by a publication called In These Times. The title of the story is called The Iraq War on Drugs, and it's reporting a disturbing trend among men and women in Iraq, in country, who are going through these difficult times. Soldiers are being cycled back into the hot zone before they are really healed. They may be physically okay, but they are not emotionally prepared to go back into an area in which they don't know who friendlies are, or they may be asked to make life and death decisions on mm-hmm. people, which is even when you're sure you're shooting at a bad guy, an unfriendly, is not an easy thing to do. At least it wouldn't be for me. And so what is happening here is that soldiers are getting bags of antidepressants and sleeping meds to help them cope.
Mm-hmm.
And this is leading to other problems because you're winding up with soldiers mm-hmm. who are addicted to these things. You're winding up with soldiers who are getting Ambien, you know, or sleeping drugs, rather. Mm-hmm. In lieu of psychological counseling for some of the right. horrible things that these guys have seen. As a fellow at work said the other day, I don't know how I would react if I were riding along in a car and one moment out of the blue, something happened and my buddy's brains were splattered all over my uniform. Yeah, I don't know how I would react to that either.
Well,
and these guys don't have the manpower to take guys out of service long enough to give them the kind of counseling and treatment they need to get over stuff like that.
You know what? The Iraq War, this is not anything new.
Mm-mm.
This went on probably in World War I and II.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, you get, I know it went on during Vietnam. I know it went on during the Korean War. it probably went on. And every time a soldier has to go out, and you've always got someone who simply can't take it. And
right.
Not one of us knows who that's going to be until it happens.
Yeah.
For whatever reason, you know, frankly, I think there's something to be lauded about the person who is so emotionally scarred over seeing these horrors that he or she finds it difficult to go back and do it again.
Right.
I'd say that person is someone I, you know, I think I can relate to that.
Yeah.
But it's the person who, oh, no, I have no problem. Send me back.
That's,
you know, would, that for would whatever be the reason, you've been able to, that person is able to compartmentalize that in a way that I don't think I could.
Right. And, well, we've talked about how video games and other aspects of our culture aimed at youth are perhaps designed to inoculate or indoctrinate, is the word I was looking for, kids to compartmentalize in that way, to just view it as like a video game, you know. Terry Hook Gross, who hosts a show on NPR called Fresh Air, interviewed a vet, an Iraq War vet named John Crawford, who said flat out that some of the soldiers have turned to self-medicating themselves in order to prepare themselves to go back out on the streets.
Mm-hmm.
And that they were so, he was quoted as saying, we were so junked out on Valium, we had no emotions anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I mean, that's just not healthy. That's just not healthy.
Let me share something with you that, actually, I haven't talked to you about this at all. A listener sent in an email, and I'll show it to you later, with a link to what I think, and the listener also agrees, it looks like it's a British version of scare tactics. You know, that show where the person doesn't know he or she is being, you know, put on, and the whole point is to make that person terrified. The technology used in this show actually has video games set up. The unknowing person comes in, and there are strobe lights built into this video game that are done in such a way that they literally put the person into a hypnotic state.
Hmm.
This person was then transported with his friends, so his friends could watch and be amused, to a site that looked identical to the setting of the video game. When he woke up, he had a weapon in his hands, and real zombies were coming at him. And he panicked at first, but then got right into the groove of killing them. And, of course, these were all actors. And once he had gotten to a certain point and they'd all gotten their amusement, then he was taken into his trance again with signals that I'm not really sure how it was all, how it all worked. He was transported back to the video game venue. And when he awakened once more, he was in front of the game and he just sort of laughed and he said, wow, that was the most realistic game I've ever played.
Yeah, that's frightening because it makes you wonder whether that tactic is already being used, that technique is already being used. To prepare soldiers
for...
Yeah,
I'll give you the link so you can put it in the show notes because it is eye-opening to watch.
That is frightening. Well, we're moving very quickly through this program, but boy, there's a lot of stuff out there.
Yeah, interestingly, we got to do the decider thing, though. You got to talk about that.
Well, yeah, that is really a strange deal that is being reported by Salon.com. Sidney Blumenthal wrote the article. Of course, he was one of the members of Bill Clinton's inner circle,
right,
and is now a columnist, definitely a left of center viewpoint on things, but you know, seems to have some sources here that indicate that
he is reporting George Bush Sr. demanded that Rumsfeld step down,
and that George Jr. refuse. It's interesting that Daddy Bush still feels as though he's got some pull inside the administration. In fact, George H.W. Bush, according to Blumenthal, went so far as to contact, without talking to his son first, the President of the United States, talking to a retired four-star general and offering him the position of Secretary of Defense once Rumsfeld was out of the way.
So who's really in charge? You know, when Clinton was in the White House, we had several talks about this. You and I, and I know other people had have talked about it and written about it. Who was running the show then? And I think you can ask that question regardless of who's in that chair.
Yeah.
Who is really making the decisions that affect our nation?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it is an interesting story, and we'll put a link to the article. There is a subscription required to Salon. You can subscribe for a one-day pass. You just have to sit through a commercial on the website before you read the article. But that's pretty much the gist of it. George Sr. tried to recruit somebody to take Rumsfeld's place, and George Jr. said, no, I'm the decider. I decide what's best, and what's best is for Don Rumsfeld to remain. This was when the generals were stepping up. The retired generals were stepping
up
and saying,
we all remember that.
Yeah, we need to have him gone. And apparently George W. won the test of wills because Mr. Rumsfeld is still the Secretary of Defense. Moving to some more conspiratorial topics, the Bilderberg Group is beginning to gather in just outside of Ottawa, Canada. The guy who's sort of the dean of the Bilderberg Group press corps, if there were to be such a thing, you know, basically the dean of the guys who show up and are escorted out by security, is Jim Tucker, who's a reporter for the American Free Press. Mr. Tucker is 71 years old, and God love him, he's been chasing these fellows all over the Northern Hemisphere for the last 20 years. He's 71 years old, and he's convinced that his sources are right and that they are going to be meeting at the Brook Street Hotel outside of Ottawa. And this is the weekend when they're supposed to meet. We'll find out if he's right, but he's been right every year that we've been paying attention to this, and that's going back 5-6 years now. So the Brook Street Hotel is a very, Tony is a good word, Tony Resort.
Yes, that is a good word.
And he believes, if he is correct, that he will be, at least not rubbing shoulders with, but he'll at least be watching from afar such luminaries as David Rockefeller, Henry Kissinger, Prime Minister Stephen Harper, who will be making his first appearance, apparently. We wait with bated breath to find out which up-and-coming American politicians will be in attendance.
Oh, that will be very interesting indeed.
Yeah, might get a glimpse
of it. Now, what are the dates of the meetings?
This weekend, June 8th through 12th.
Are they going to watch the World Cup games together?
Could be. So we'll be keeping an eye on that. And I'll put another link to the Bilderberg.org website, which is run by a fellow in the UK named Tony Gosling. And he keeps tabs on what these guys do year round. So he'll be watching them. Jim Tucker will be the reporter on the scene, assuming that his sources are correct. And we think they are. And we should know more about who was there and what they talked about by next week at this time.
You know, speaking of conspiracies, here's a very odd story. The hand of John the Baptist arrives in Moscow. Film at 11.
Yeah.
I wasn't even aware that there was a relic of the hand of John the Baptist.
I didn't know that either.
There is, though. I did some research. Indeed, they're supposedly, it's reputed to be that of John the Baptist. His right forearm and hand.
Now, I would like to find out what paths this particular relic has taken. Apparently, it was in Russia for quite a while, from 1799 to 1917. But the trip that it made today was to Moscow from a church in Montenegro, which, of course, is part of the former Yugoslavia. Just declared independence from Serbia, by the way. So what's interesting about this is that John is one of the two Johns revered by the Freemasons. And as we pointed out a number of times, the symbol of Russia, the official symbol, as decreed by Vladimir Putin, is that double-headed eagle of Lagash, which is the symbol of 32nd and 33rd degree Scottish Rite Freemasons.
And I found an article online that is actually written by a man who is a Mason. And one of the images he used in his article about the Saints John that are revered by Masonry, at least American Freemasonry. Apparently over in Britain, they revere Moses and Solomon. Whether or not they lean toward the, I think Scotland started the Johns thing. So, of course, we're Scottish right over here. The picture on this website with the article was that of a two-faced man.
The god Janus.
It looked to me like the god Janus, because Janus is two-faced.
Right.
The month of January is named after Janus because Janus looks both ways. And that's very typical of the solstice, because the solstice is looking toward the dying sun and the the waxing sun. I'm not really sure what you call it. The growing sun, the awakening sun. It's this notion over in the Celtic world of the Holly King and the Oak King. There's always one dying and one coming back, one rising again. And supposedly at the summer solstice, that is the feast of St. John. And this is arriving just in time for that.
That's right. The summer solstice is the 21st of this month, isn't it?
Right. We've got Vladimir Putin, who wants to be the energy king of the world.
Mm-hmm.
And it reminds me of an episode of Millennium.
Mm-hmm.
In the second season of Millennium, there was a show called The Hand of St. Sebastian.
Right.
And that whole season is great. Some disagree with us. They say the third is better, but no, the second's best.
No, they're wrong, aren't they?
The Hand of St. Sebastian. And I talked to you at lunchtime today, and I asked you if maybe the Hand of St. Sebastian episode was actually a cover, and they were really talking about the Hand of St. John, because whoever possessed that had power to rule the world.
Yeah, according to the legend about the Hand of St. Sebastian, whoever possessed it possessed the knowledge necessary to defeat evil.
Yeah.
Yeah. I don't know what the legend is behind the Hand of St. John.
I don't know what John it is Revelator. Either, but I guess what I'm saying is if they really meant the Hand of St. John.
No, I'm sorry, John the Baptist, not John the Revelator.
No,
I apologize.
John the Baptist.
Well, that's interesting.
Mm-hmm.
That is very interesting. And yes, that's our research topic for the night. Quick sidetrack before we get to our interview down to the Dark Continent. I found this story interesting and very bothersome. Mogadishu has fallen to Al-Qaeda-supported Islamic militia.
Oh, dear.
Mogadishu is in Somalia, and of course it was the site of the movie and the incident which inspired the movie, Black Hawk Down.
Yeah.
During the Clinton administration, you remember that we had sent a humanitarian effort to Mogadishu, to Somalia, to try to feed the starving people there because of a humanitarian crisis. They were attacked and set upon by warlords, and the rescue mission to pull our soldiers out wasn't entirely successful, and a number of our soldiers were killed. Their bodies were dragged through the streets. It was a humiliating episode in American military history, one that we would like to forget. If you've seen the movie Black Hawk Down, you know what I'm talking about.
Well, and supposedly terrorists watch that movie routinely.
Yeah. Well, apparently what we've been doing, well, I shouldn't say we, what the CIA has been doing, and this is another example of a story coming out that makes the CIA look bad, by the way. This is published in the New York Times today. A covert effort has been underway in Somalia by the CIA, working out of their station in Nairobi, Kenya, to finance the warlords as a counterweight against what they perceive to be an Al-Qaeda threat in Somalia. There were a few Al-Qaeda operatives working in Somalia, we thought, and so the CIA determined that the best course of action was to funnel money to the warlords. They were paying the guys who killed our soldiers on the streets of Mogadishu.
That's disgusting.
That is disgusting. And what's happened in response, and the State Department is furious about this apparently, that the response from the people in Somalia was to turn to the Al-Qaeda-based Islamic militia for protection against the warlords. And in recent battles, the militia have apparently kicked the warlords out of Mogadishu and taken control of the city, the capital city of Somalia.
Mm.
So what are we doing over there? What game are these guys playing? What rules do they operate under?
I don't know, but I'd like to go back to the old days when the United States just stayed home.
Yeah.
We weren't trying to run the world. We were just trying to be a good country.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'm going to throw in one last story, and it'll be quick. We just reported a few days ago on Javier Solana's visit to Iran. Apparently, despite his visit, Ahmadinejad has decided to start nuclear enrichment again. In fact, he started the very day that Javier Solana arrived. Now, I don't know if Solana was aware of that. He should have his own website, solana.com. Don't you think that'd be good?
Yeah.
No, poor Javier. He must be heartbroken.
Well,
I took a package. I made offers. I bought him lunch. I don't know.
I brought cookies. I don't know what else I could have done.
I don't know. Unless, of course, he went there And whatever deal he worked out, he said, you may begin enriching again. And that was the whole point of his visit.
Could be. Or it could be that the offer that was made was one that we knew, or that Solana knew, that Iran was just not going to accept anyway.
You know, he doesn't travel around for nothing, though. If he went all the way to Iran personally, there's something to that trip.
Yep. Well, all we can do is watch from afar and try to discern, as through a glass darkly.
Yeah, well, you know what? Our next guest discerns very, very well, we think. And I am sure that you've been enjoying parts one and two of David W. Lowe's interview. So we're going to keep you waiting no longer. Here's part three.
Wrapping up our week of prophetic discussion with David Lowe, author of Earthquake Resurrection. And David, we've been talking about the sixth seal, which is the next one to be opened according to your prophetic model. So let's look back then. Where were the first five, and how did we miss them?
I slept through them. I don't know about you.
Yeah, we they must have went by really fast if we missed them. No, one thing that I think is important that I cover in my book is if you look back at Revelation chapter 5 and Revelation chapter 6, a lot of people place thousands of years in between what happens at the end of Revelation chapter 5 and then the beginning of Revelation chapter 6. And there's really no reason to do that. You know, the chapters in Revelation are were put there by man, where John was actually seeing these things continuously, and there were no chapter breaks. So we really shouldn't put thousands of years in between Revelation chapter 5 and chapter 6. We should just read it as if John was seeing it as a continuous vision. One of the things I want to talk about is look at Revelation chapter 5. You know, that there's many Old Testament verses which talk about God's right hand, but there's only one that prophesies that the Lord, or Jesus Christ, would sit down at God's right hand, and it's Psalm 110, verse 1. It says, here's the Lord's proclamation to my Lord. Sit down at my right hand until I make your enemies your footstool. Well, that probably sounds familiar because it's a verse that the apostles used over and over in the book of Acts to prove that David wasn't referring to himself, but he was referring to Jesus. When he said, the Lord said unto my Lord, well, David's not, you know, not referring to himself there. He's referring to Jesus Christ. So if you look at what happened traditionally after Jesus ascended to heaven, you see, just before Jesus was crucified, he himself said that he was going to sit down at God's right hand. In Matthew 26:64, he says to Caiaphas, you have said it yourself, but I tell you, from now on you will see the Son of Man sitting at the right hand of the power and of God and coming on the clouds of heaven. So if we keep reading, such as Luke and Mark and some of these Gospels, they confirm that what Jesus did right after his ascension was he sat down at God's right hand, Mark 16:19. After the Lord Jesus had spoken to them, he was taken up into heaven and sat down at the right hand of God. So what am I talking about with reference to Revelation chapter 5? Is there evidence of Christ's first century ascension in Revelation chapter 5? And I think that there is. If you look at the opening of Revelation chapter 5, you see a description of the throne room and a seven-sealed scroll, which is going to be opened. Now, the important thing in the very first verses is to notice where that scroll is located.
It's in the right hand of God.
Exactly. Revelation 5:1, then I saw in the right hand of the one who was seated on the throne a scroll. And so who eventually opens the scroll? Well, it's the Lamb, Jesus Christ, but he's not there.
That's right.
Revelation
That's a good point.
5:2-3. No one in heaven or earth was, or under the earth, was able to open the scroll. Now wait a second. If Revelation 4 and 5, according to the traditional models, is in the future, then Jesus Christ should be sitting at the right hand of God.
That's right. Okay.
Because in Mark chapter 16:19, it says he sat down at the right hand of God. We see also, as Stephen was being stoned, he said he saw Jesus standing at the right hand of God. Paul and Peter, in their epistles, wrote that Jesus Christ is sitting at the right hand of God and interceding for us. When this priest had offered one sacrifice for sins, he says in Hebrews, he sat down at the right hand of God where he is now waiting until his enemies are made a footstool.
Mm-hmm.
So that begs the question, if this is in the future, Revelation chapter 5, where is Jesus? He should be there. He should be sitting at God's right hand, but he isn't. Then if you keep reading the rest of Revelation chapter 5, you see one of the elders say, stop weeping. Here comes Jesus. Then I saw standing in the middle of the throne and the four living creatures, a lamb that had appeared to have been killed.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. What does that tell us? Well, it tells us that the crucifixion was something that was still fresh and new. A lamb that appeared to have been killed. It's talking about the lamb that was slain,
mm-hmm.
the lamb that was killed on the cross. So, what happens after this lamb appears in Revelation chapter 5? The first action he takes, Revelation 5:7, after he appears, then he came and took the scroll from the right hand of the one that was seated on the throne. So in order to take it from his right hand, he had to move to his right hand. So what am I saying here? I'm saying
mm-hmm.
that this is a picture of the ascension of Jesus Christ in the first century, and John was able to see it in a vision. He was able to see Jesus appear all of a sudden where he wasn't there, and then he was there. And then he sees him move to the right hand of God. And now we know what he is doing at the right hand of God. He's getting ready to open the scroll. He's getting ready to break the seals on the scroll. Now, it's at this point that the 24 elders and the four living creatures sing their famous song. They say, you are willing to take the scroll and open the seals because you were killed, and at the cost of your blood you have purchased for God persons from every tribe, language, people, and nation. So what we're seeing here is a new song about Jesus being crucified. Well, if it was 2,000 years in the future, as the traditional models say, Revelation chapter 5 is, they're waiting 2,000 years to sing a new song about Jesus' death. It makes more sense that they're singing a new song back in the first century
mm-hmm.
when this just had happened and Jesus had just ascended to heaven. Then these angelic beings start singing and praising God and saying, singing this new song, you've just purchased persons. You've just established your kingdom and priesthood, and you know, they will reign on the earth. So, in my view, it makes more sense that Revelation chapter 5 is taking place in the first century. And then we move into chapter 6, where he begins to open those seals still in the first century. So, then we come to, okay, how did we miss those seals being open? What are you talking about?
Right. Okay, seal number one, the rider on the white horse.
Mm-hmm.
The rider on the white horse, that's right. You know, the traditional interpretation is that it is the Antichrist.
Mm-hmm.
It is something that hasn't happened yet, but is going to happen in the future. However, if you look at the four horsemen and you compare them to something in Zechariah chapters 1 through 6, you'll see four horses as four spirits of heaven that are presenting themselves before the Lord. And the horses in Zechariah were symbolic of spirits, and there were four. So
mm-hmm.
it makes sense that these are probably, if not the same four horses, that they're similar,
mm-hmm.
that they're spirits, and that they've always been around. And it's not something that's going to be unleashed in the future. These are spirits that have been around perhaps since the beginning of time. And what I think is going on here is these are evil spirits that are at work within the symbolism of the first four seals of Revelation chapter 6. They're unseen enemies that continuously oppress and deceive the human race, and they carry out a satanic prophetic agenda on the earth. So, looking at the first seal, what do we have? Well, we have a white horse and a bow, a victor's wreath crown, and the rider who has a mission to conquer and dominate.
Mm-hmm.
Now, white the white horse and white within the Bible is almost always symbolic of something that is positive.
Yeah.
And I believe in this case it should also be something that is, in this case I believe it should be something that is interpreted in a negative manner, and here's why. The other three horses are symbolic in a negative manner. They're carrying out war, they're carrying out famine, they're carrying out all kinds of oppression, and it's in a negative manner. So it follows that this horse should also be interpreted in a negative manner. Now, let's just get down to what I believe that the first seal is. I believe that the first seal is a symbolic of an evil conquering spirit going forth into the earth in the first century using a religious system and using the name of Christ, which is a false use of the of white, a false use of something positive.
Right, the spirit of Antichrist.
The spirit, right.
Dominionism.
Right, with conquest and domination of the masses as the goal. And then you have the symbols of the bow and the crown, which are further representations of a conquering and dominating spirit.
Mm-hmm.
Now, I think what I said was any religious order that uses the name of Christ, and I don't want to single out any religion or any religious sect that uses the name of Christ to be represented within this first seal, but I think that the Catholic Church, the traditional Roman Catholic Church, is really the standard to go by when trying to interpret what Jesus was opening back in that first century.
Well, throughout history that would be true, but again, I mentioned dominionism because it certainly is the case today that we're seeing people going out to conquer in the name of Christ who are representing themselves as Protestant for the most part.
Well, and I would say look at the word bow, because that's also used in the Old Testament as God's rainbow. That's the same word.
Yeah, that is very interesting that he's holding a bow.
It doesn't, you know, we always think, oh, bow and arrow, but there are no arrows mentioned. Maybe it's a rainbow.
Meaning a peaceful sort of oppression. And
that's
kind of what I said in the book is they use Christianity, they use the name of Jesus Christ or the gospel, but they use it to force and to coerce and to brainwash people throughout history, to brainwash people. They're led by a spirit of religious domination. And that's what I believe is symbolized in this first seal.
That's a very interesting interpretation of it, and it's very compelling to consider. I'm going to have to go back and do some more study on that.
I know.
That's a very interesting interpretation.
All of our listeners are getting out thumbing through.
Yeah. No way.
Well, if you look at, you know, the Pontifex Maximus through the Imperial Roman Empire, the Edict of Toleration through Constantine, the Inquisitions, the Crusades, all of these things for the history of the Catholic Church, they're forcing and they're coercing people to, you know, buy into the name of Christ. But it's really not that way. Jesus Christ was the exact opposite of that.
That's right.
You know, look at some of the ways they tried to dominate the heads of states. They tried to dominate people through declaring that salvation was only through their church. They carried out horrible violence against people who dissented against the Catholic Church, namely the true Christians throughout the centuries, you know, burning people at the stakes and whatnot, feeding them to the lions.
You know, I would say it's more than just the Catholic Church, though. Derek used the word dominionism. There are Protestants the Kingdom Now Protestants, who believe that only through changing everybody to a democracy can we bring in the true Christianity? Can we bring Messiah back?
Absolutely.
So, yeah, it does cross the boundary lines. But, of course, as you mentioned, David, yeah, going through the history of the world, Western history certainly has been shaped by the influence and the coercion of those who use the political power, the earthly power of the Roman Catholic Church.
Absolutely.
So we've got the other seals then. We've got the second seal and the rider on the red horse, the black horse, and then the pale horse.
Absolutely. The rider on the red horse, you know, I agree that with a traditional interpretation that it symbolizes war, and it uses some verbs in there that are pretty violent. It causes people to violently butcher one another. I see this as something that has definitely been present all throughout history. But this seal was opened in the first century, and this spirit was granted permission or given permission to carry out, to cause people to do this, to do these things. And we see this throughout the wars and just violent killing. Something that's interesting about the third seal, which is the black horse, the traditional interpretation is that he's holding a pair of balance scales. The Greek word there is zugon, and in the New Testament, that Greek word zugon is translated 37 times, all 37 times, as a yoke that is used to constrain cattle, or a yoke that is placed around a person's neck. You know, Jesus said, my yoke is easy, my burden is light.
Right.
Well, he's using the verb, the noun zugon there. Right here is the only time in the New Testament where it's translated as balance scales. And I believe that is an erroneous interpretation. I believe that it should, that what he is holding, what that black horse rider is holding, is a yoke. And I believe that the seal is referring to a type of financial oppression. Oppression through the means of economic means. Financial, manipulating currencies, manipulating prices of goods, things like that. And what he was symbolizing with that yoke is that you're going to place the people, like the cattle, in a yoke and constrain them and oppress them.
It's a form of bondage.
Exactly. It's a form of bondage. And boy, do we see that today, not only in America, but all throughout the world with the central banking system. I mean, to me, it's pretty clear that that's exactly what is being symbolized here. And it wasn't only in modern times; it was also in the Roman Empire, and that was largely the reason for their demise, was some of the economic decisions that they tried to make. But what I find very interesting, I hope we have time for this, is a short quote by Thomas Jefferson. He said, "We must not let our leaders load us with perpetual debt. We must make our election between economy and liberty, or profusion and servitude. If we run into such debt as that, we must be taxed in our meat and our drink, in our necessaries and our comforts, in our labors and our amusements. We will have no time to think, no means of calling our mismanagers to account, but be glad to obtain subsistence by hiring ourselves to rivet their chains on the necks of our fellow sufferers." This is a tendency of all human governments. And he says, "A departure from principle in one instance becomes a precedent until the bulk of society is reduced to mere automatons of misery. The forehorse of this frightful team is public debt, and taxation follows it." So what Thomas Jefferson was saying from his experience was that governments try to tax and try to put financial oppression on the people, and what it reduces the common people into is automatons of misery. And he even talks about chains on the necks, just like this black horse and the yoke that he's carrying.
Very interesting. Now we're down to the last couple of minutes of our time here, David. The fourth horse, the pale horse, of course, deals with wars, famines, plagues, and
that's right. The one thing I want to point out before we close out is these are all things that we see in the natural world. These are not something supernatural, that these opening of the seals, these first four seals, and even the fifth seal where we see Christians being martyred. We've seen that all throughout history from the first century.
Mm-hmm.
We see everything in the fourth seal even now today. You know, pestilences, plagues. We could go on and on about those kind of things.
So you think maybe we're looking for something that's bigger, and we're missing the evidence that's right in front of our eyes?
That's right. I do. You know, it says that they're in the fourth seal, they're able to kill one. They're given power to kill one fourth of the Earth's population. Well, who's to say that they're not doing that through the myriad of different kinds of cancers, plagues, pestilences, violence, all the different means of killing people that's taking place currently.
And the right to choose.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I mean, that we have lost millions over the last 25 years.
Yeah, in the United States, it's been equivalent to more than the entire population of the nation of Canada since Roe v. Wade. It's over 45 million.
Absolutely. I believe that these seals have definitely been open. We're seeing them in the natural world right now. There's nothing supernatural about them other than a spirit is granted authority to carry them out. And humans have made the choice to participate, to carry out in the natural what these spirits are tempting or asking for permission to do.
It's the very thing that Derek and I talk about all the time on PID Radio, and that is that there are politicians making decisions that affect billions of people's lives, but it's not just the human, it's the spiritual battle that's going on. It's the spirit behind the human.
Oh, no question.
And judging by the title of your book, David, Earthquake Resurrection, and given that you place the beginning of the day of the Lord, when the earth reels like a drunkard, as Isaiah says,
that's right,
at the opening of the sixth seal, my guess is that we're not going to miss, well, hopefully we will.
We'll be heading off about that time.
But the world as a whole will not miss when that sixth seal is opened. Am I correct in that?
Absolutely. In a nutshell, I believe that the earthquake resurrection and the catching up is going to take place right at the opening of that sixth seal. There's going to be the 2004 tsunami was sort of a mini preview of what's going to happen. You're going to see mountains moving, islands moving, earthquake, tsunamis, volcanic activity. You're going to see all these things. If you're left behind, that is. The ones who are caught up are going to be caught up into the air to meet the Lord in the air. And there's a passage in Isaiah 26 that maybe the listeners will want to go look at. It's verses 19 through 21, and it's a perfect chronology of what's going to happen. We're going to see a resurrection. We're going to see my people caught up into their inner rooms, and then we're going to see the beginning of God's wrath unleashed on the earth. And it's because the earth is defiled with the guilt of shedding innocent blood. And that's something I'd like to talk about in the future, is the reason the plagues, or the reason that the judgments, the trumpets and the bowls have to be poured out on the earth, is because the earth is defiled with guilt of the blood of the innocent. And it's said over and over in the book of Revelation that the reason that the judgments are poured out is because the blood had been shed in the earth. And do we expect Jesus Christ to come back and rule on an earth that is defiled with the guilt and shedding of innocent blood? That has to happen first. It has to be cleansed. It has to be sanctified. The earth has to be changed before he can begin and rule in that millennial reign in the future.
Excellent.
That's what it's all about.
Excellent way to close. We wish we had more time, but we'll definitely bring you back.
This time went so quickly.
This was about the quickest hour of interview that we've had in a long time. And David W. Lowe, author of Earthquake Resurrection, we do look forward to having you back. Thanks for being our guest on PID Radio, David.
Thanks again, guys. It was really a privilege. I look forward to talking to you again in the future, and hope everyone will look into getting the book. It's www.earthquakeresurrection.com. Thanks
a lot. Thank you, David.
Everything you want to know about David W. Lowe and Earthquake Resurrection are available at www.earthquakeresurrection.com.
Boy, can it be that we've come to the end of our prophecy series?
Yes, amazingly enough. And it appears there was quite a bit of interest. I was just checking the server statistics for this past couple of weeks.
Oh, yeah?
There's been a real spike over the last couple of weeks as we've been
going through
these topics.
Maybe that's why the servers crashed twice. with our service.
It could be. Our host company appears to be having a little trouble. If you've had some trouble logging onto the website or downloading the shows over the last few days, the last day or so, we've had some spotty service with the host company, which is really unusual. They've been very, very reliable during our time with mm-hmm. them. So be patient. Could be the only time we were offline for any length of time was when there was a fire in downtown Baltimore, which is, I guess, where their server farm is located. Well, and that was way beyond their control.
I will say this, that at the time this afternoon, which was about 5 Central, about 4:45, 5 o'clock Central time, that I noticed that we weren't able to connect was when I checked their site, apollohosting.com,
mm-hmm.
and that site wouldn't come up either.
Yeah.
So it could well be that there was a major problem with all of their, with everything.
Yeah.
But it's fixed now.
If you do have an issue with the downloads or what have you, and we do understand that over the last few days, it seems like there have been some slow download times, and we are looking into some possible solutions for moving the audio files perhaps to its own dedicated, you know, podcast-only yeah. server solution.
We're trying really, really hard to avoid that awful choice of having to charge. We really don't want to go there. Because that's not what we feel our ministry.
You know, things have been given freely to us, the time of the guests, so we're just looking for a creative solution to continue to offer all of the archive programs the way we have all along.
So what we're going to do is we're coming to your homes. We're going on a tour.
We're setting up a network of what am I looking for? What's the word I'm looking for? Tin can and string. Connected with...
That'd be great.
Fiber optic string or something.
Yeah, really good string.
Really great.
Really good string.
Well, tomorrow night we got a full program of news commentary and blather, and we will be talking about some other things in the news that we just haven't had an opportunity to get to this week, Prozac for 8-year-olds.
Oh, yeah, Prozac, we'll talk about that tomorrow story. Night. Don't even get me started. I'm going to rant on that tomorrow.
Yep, and we will be discussing some other things, too, and perhaps talk a little bit more about al-Zarqawi and the political fallout and what happens next in Iraq. Is this perhaps the beginning of the exit strategy from Iraq? Huh? Exit with honor? We got the bad guy, now we can leave?
Well, that could be. That would be wonderful, actually. Keep an eye on things this weekend because the World Cup starts today.
Mm-hmm. The attention of the world is focused on it, even though we in America
may be paying. We don't think much about it.
Yeah, we'll be paying more attention to the Cardinals game, but the world is focused on the World Cup.
It really is. So mm-hmm. this is a time when something well could
yes.
be planned. So if you're planning to go over there to one of the games, then. Mm-hmm. We let us know. We'll all pray for your trip.
Yeah. And remember, 6-11 is a 9-11 in reverse, sort of.
Honey, that's good. Yeah, that's true.
Well, that was something there Captain May put
Captain
out on his
May.
Ghost Troop list.
And we need to
today.
Have him back on here again mm-hmm. soon. Speaking of guests, next Tuesday, we're going to be speaking again with Janet Phelan.
Yep. And the following week, as we get into our series, our summertime conspiracy series, we'll be talking about HAARP. With Jerry E. Smith.
Mm-hmm. So lots of good things in store. In the meanwhile, I will remain Sharon Gilbert.
And I'm Derek Moonbat. Thanks for listening to PIB
Radio. I got
to
say, though, the reason I laughed is we've got a counter so we don't go too long. And I just looked up and it said 33.3.
Oh!
We better go. Have a great evening, everybody.
Bye-bye. Gonna step up to the microphone.